Washington Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session. Honorable Ronald Fox presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Before I call the first case, are counsel for the third case, Fox versus Skagit County, present?
Present, Your Honor, for Fox.
Okay, I just want to give you a heads up. Our expectation, of course, is that the appellant will obviously argue first. There are three respondents, as we understand, for the case, and it would be most helpful to this court if the order of argument for the respondents is Skagit County first, Department of Ecology, and then the tribe. So when we start, what I would like is an indication whether that order of argument is something that you don't want to follow. It's your choice how you want to argue the case. And two, I'd like a designation of what each respondent will take in order of the 20 minutes that are allocated to that side. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. The first case is State versus Batson. And I take it the parties are ready.
We are, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. Mick Voinarevsky with the Washington Appellate Project, and it is my privilege to represent Benjamin Batson this morning. If I could please reserve 3 minutes.
Three? Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, Mr. Batson is 61 years old. Half a lifetime ago, he was convicted of an act that King County and Pierce County prosecutors concede would not be a criminal offense in our state. Nevertheless, because in 2010, the legislature amended the registration statute and took a shortcut, eliminating the requirement that out-of-state convictions that would require registration here be comparable to Washington state offenses, Mr. Batson remains hounded by his past. Whether the court examines this case through the prism of the sufficiency challenge that we're making, or whether the court takes a big picture view of Mr. Batson's predicament, there's only one conclusion that can be drawn, which is that his conviction should be reversed.
It would be most helpful to the panel if you would first deal with the sufficiency challenge.
Yes, Your Honor. In State v. Peterson, the state Supreme Court made it clear that, in general, in a failure to register case, proof of residency is not an element. However, in this particular case, the way that Mr. Batson was charged, the state took on the burden of proving that he lacked a fixed address. Under the authority of State v. Hickman, when the state assumes an extra element, they are bound to prove it. With respect to Mr. Batson, the state failed to discharge that obligation under the law. As the court may recall, even the trial judge in dealing with this motion called it a close call. Specifically, there was evidence that Mr. Batson's last address was at the St. Martin's of Porres shelter, and that location would qualify as a fixed address. Some shelter programs can do so, and I believe the evidence was sufficient that the allotment of the cot, an assigned spot for an individual who would be staying there, fits within the definition of a fixed residence.
We understand that argument, and the state apparently contested it, in part, at least according to the briefing, because it contends that Mr. Batson was, quote, homeless, close quote. Can you address that?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a misnomer in the sense that the statute clearly differentiates what it means to be homeless from what it means to lack a fixed residence. And under the statute, homeless individuals who stay in shelters that meet the statutory definition of a fixed residence do not have a weekly registration requirement. I think that's the situation that Mr. Batson found himself in. The other point of contention with respect to this evidence, I suppose, was the idea that Mr. Batson's ability to stay at the shelter was gone because he had moved out or he had been taken into custody and lost his spot. The state did not present any direct evidence of that. The shelter director didn't know him, didn't speak to Mr. Batson.
I understand from the record that Mr. Batson did not testify.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And so we have nothing in the record to actually show what was going on during the charging period with respect to fixed residence, other than the testimony of the director and testimony of the detective.
Yes, Your Honor. The state did not present any evidence as to Mr. Batson's whereabouts during the charging period, where, as I said before, they took on the responsibility of proving that he lacked a fixed residence. If I may, I'd like to address the unlawful delegation of legislative authority argument, which I think is an interesting one. It's certainly not a grounds for challenging a statute that comes up all that often, and I think that reflects the fact that the folks down in Olympia get it right most of the time. They do what they are duty-bound to do, which is enact laws. In this particular case, we see something rather different. We see very much like I think it's Dougal, State v. Dougal, the 1977 case, what we see is a turning over of lawmaking power that to another lawmaking body. Specifically, there are 50 sister states. In Dougal, a unanimous state Supreme Court struck down a statute that incorporated future definitions of controlled substances under federal law. And that's the problem that we have here. The registration statute as it's written that says if you have an out-of-state duty to register somewhere for whatever reason that may be, you must register here, is an acceptance of all the laws currently on the books in our 50 sister states, no matter how rational or irrational they may be. And it's an acceptance of any changes those other 50 legislatures may make to those laws for the future. This cannot be. I think once in a while we get these odd cases where something that doesn't come up before the court all that often actually does. And I think this is one of those instances. I would note that the other time, and I tried to find this authority, but one of the more recent appellate court decisions on unlawful delegation is the State v. Ramos case that had to do with the unlawful delegation made by the legislature to county sheriffs with respect to how sex offender classification levels are to be decided. Your Honor, with the little bit of time that I have in opening, I also want to talk about the as-applied equal protection challenge that we're making on Mr. Batson's behalf. Certainly, all folks are due to equal treatment under the laws. I want to be very clear that we're not making a facial invalidity challenge under equal protection, just an as-applied one. I think that's appropriate in this context. It allows this court to resolve the narrow controversy before you today. And it is indeed unusual in that Mr. Batson is being required to register as a sex offender for something that is not a crime in Washington today, nor was it a crime in Washington when that act of statutory rape occurred in Arizona. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Morning. May it please the court. I'm Donna Wise, representing the state of Washington. I first want to address briefly the picture that Mr. Batson presents of himself as a man who had youthful indiscretion and is not dangerous, and dispute the fact that the state has conceded that the act he committed in 1984 would not be a crime here. He has asserted that he had consensual sex with a 16-year-old. The state conceded the crime in Arizona is not comparable to a crime in Washington. But if you look at the pre-sentence report for the Arizona conviction, it reports repeated rapes of the victim over a day and a half in an isolated location. The original charges were kidnapping and rape, and this was a result of plea negotiation that he pled to these two charges. And also note that when he was arrested for this offense, it was because he was being investigated for rape. That was excluded at trial because counsel thought it was prejudicial, legitimately so. Nevertheless, let's talk about the picture we're painting of Mr. Batson. Mr. Batson also is classified as a level 3 sex offender, again, the highest level of risk. So when we're looking at the picture of this case and the equities and the allegation that this is a poor, innocent man who's being harassed by the state, I would like the court to keep those facts in mind as well. And since the court is interested in the sufficiency of the evidence, perhaps I'll start with that as well, and you can ask any questions you have about that. Your Honor, the state's position is that Mr. Batson was registered with King County at the St. Martin de Porres shelter, which its director stated was a shelter for homeless men. Mr. Batson had registered as homeless with King County since, I believe it was April 2009, at different shelters, and registered at the St. Martin de Porres shelter in December of 2011. It's the state's position that the evidence was sufficient to establish that he continued in that status as homeless. He listed the shelter as a place he could be contacted. The shelter, according to the testimony, does not qualify as a shelter that can be a fixed residence because it doesn't have an assigned space where a person can keep their property.
Well, that's the issue. And when we look at instruction number 13 that has two paragraphs, the first of which clearly is inapplicable to this situation because that paragraph defines a fixed residence as essentially what we normally think of as a fixed residence. The second paragraph, however, is at issue, and it reflects the statutory language that indicates that the legislature gave some thought to a situation where a person is homeless. My reading of that second paragraph is that there are essentially three provisos that allow a shelter program to qualify as a fixed residence, the first of which is that the shelter program is designed to provide temporary living accommodations for the homeless. And I take it you don't contest that proviso?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So what we're really talking about is the second and third of the provisos, the first of which is it provides an offender with a personally assigned living space, and then the other is the offender is permitted to store belongings in the living space. You said that they don't qualify, but I guess I'd like an explanation why.
Well, the testimony from the director, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, the director of the home shelter was that a person who continuously stays at the shelter has a mat. That mat, that does not indicate that the mat is a personally assigned living space. They have a mat. They have a place to stay the next night if they have continuously stayed at the shelter. So I think that does not establish that the shelter provides a personally assigned living space. There was no indication of that yes, this is Joe's space, this is George's space. That's not what the testimony was. They have a mat. In addition, what the court, or pardon me, what the director said was that the offender, the statute refers to it as the offender, but the person staying at the shelter can keep personal belongings, but not in the area where they sleep, not in that living area, but someplace else in the building. And that's made clear in the testimony because the director testified that a person who stays overnight can only have access to it three times during the course of the evening. I'm not sure whether those are specific times or you just get three chances. But it's clear that it's not in the area where the person is sleeping and staying. So I think the testimony from the director establishes that neither one of those second and third qualifications applies.
The testimony also indicated that there was a provision that allowed storage during the daytime. Would that not fulfill the requirement to provide storage access to a person?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the statute indicates that there has to be a personally assigned living space, and then the next clause is they're permitted to store belongings in the living space. To me, that indicates that whether it's sort of a ward setup or a barracks setup where You have a cot, you have a locker, just like in the barracks in the Army. It's not a situation where everybody has a mat and you're allowed to leave things overnight. That's what the testimony was here. It really wasn't any clearer because this wasn't the issue in the case when it was tried, but that is what the evidence is. It's a mat.
So
you have a mat.
Let's pursue the Army situation. You have a large open space. You have a number of bunks, and you have a footlocker, for example, at the foot of each bunk. Is that the only situation that qualifies for personally assigned living space with et cetera, et cetera?
That's the one I can think of. I think that clearly qualifies. I haven't really been presented with other situations that might qualify.
Let me ask this.
Yes.
Is the rule of lenity something that applies in trying to figure out what the scope of the statutory language means? In other words, is there some other situation which would fit the terms of the statute and the terms of this particular jury instruction?
Well, I guess the question is there another reasonable interpretation
right.
of this language under which this factual situation would fit? And I don't think so, Your Honor, because when they refer to living space, they don't say building, somewhere else in the building, because that's what it is. We're talking about someone who has a right to a mat that night and is allowed to keep belongings in the building. That's not the sort of what the legislature is trying to define is a fixed residence. And when they say living space, that's living space. That's not somewhere else. The living doesn't say the building where the shelter is. So I don't think there is another reasonable interpretation that these facts fall within.
I don't want to eat up all of your time, so if you want to move on, that's fine.
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to talk a little bit about the out-of-state cases because Mr. Basson complains in his reply brief that I didn't talk about them. And they're just not relevant. The cases that talk about whether the law is an ex post facto scheme as applied to the defendant. There are two types of registration statutes, as far as I can tell. There's the type we have in Washington, which simply requires registration, and then there's the type that exists in these other states that require a lot more than registration. For example, in the Maryland case, the offender has to disclose their email, their computer login information. They have to disclose information about the vehicles that they've used. That's more than just registering once a year or weekly if you're without a fixed residence. Also, the Maryland case was decided under the Maryland Constitution. The Indiana case, the offenders in Indiana had to carry ID in form of their plans to travel for more than 72 hours. They had to give consent to monitor their computers and internet accounts. They were prohibited from living within 1,000 feet of a school. Again, this is more like parole or probation, not what we have, which is just you register. By the way, the Indiana case also was just decided under the Indiana Constitution. The Oklahoma case, Starkey, the offenders are prohibited from living within 2,000 feet of schools, playgrounds. They can't live with a child. They can't live with other sex offenders. They have to carry a driver's license. They have to renew it every year instead of every 4 years. Some of their driver's license have sex offender printed on the driver's license. Again, this is a different scheme than simply requiring the offender to register. Ward decided that our statute was constitutional. It has not been significantly changed, and I'd ask the court to affirm that finding. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honor, if I may, I'll return to the sufficiency question that the court raised. I think the barracks and the cot and locker analogy is actually a fairly useful one if we look at the way that the testimony came out. We have testimony that folks who stay at the shelter have, quote, storage boxes and hooks that get assigned to them, meaning they do have a place to store their belongings at the shelter, and they have a mat, assigned to them. I don't think it makes that much of a difference that it's not in a bunk bed fashion. With respect to the question, the court...
Well, let's talk about the proximity of the storage to the... Matt, for example.
Sure.
I think that's the prosecutor's point.
Well, let me respond in this fashion. If you look at how this court has addressed the question of what constitutes a fixed residence in other prior cases, you have never taken that narrow of an approach. I point to State v. Stratton, a case where the court reversed a failure to register conviction where that defendant was living out of his car in the driveway of his former home, which he had vacated due to a loan default. That was deemed to be a fixed residence. I'd also direct the court's attention to the to convict instruction in Mr. Batson's case, which required that the state prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he lacks a fixed residence, not that he established that he has one. I think that's the cleanest way of approaching the problem that the court has drawn out this morning.
Is fixed residence, is that the legislature's intent to define the actual building itself or the actual living space?
Thinking off the top of my head, I would go with the building as the response, because the purpose ultimately is for law enforcement to have a better grasp of where folks are staying. That's the concern. That's really, fundamentally, that's the concern, not whether the place that they are known to be at has bunk beds or in a footlocker as opposed to mats and an assigned storage hook. Your Honor, with the... certainly sufficiency that is the narrowest ground upon which the court can give Mr. Batson the relief that I believe he's entitled to. I would say that the as-applied equal protection argument is a strong one in this case. I'd also point the court, or ask the court, to take a look at the varying ways in which Mr. Batson would have available to him to get off of registration. They're much stricter than someone who would be even convicted of a Class B or Class C felony here in Washington. I do think it's problematic that the state is asking this court to consider unadjudicated conduct, things that Mr. Batson was not convicted of, as a basis to keep his registration going here in Washington. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.